Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. This week, we catch up with Haitian Creole jazz drummer John Byrne Thomas on the road and performing in Lexington soon. We explore an exhibit at the Lexington History Museum about the amazing civil rights photography of Calvert McCann. Sculptor Amanda Matthews on leading a United Nations visit to her monument to Nellie Bly on New York's Roosevelt Island. And we hear how Kentucky students are pushing for civics education. First, President Trump's use of his presidential powers to retaliate against certain law firms has sent a chill throughout the legal profession, threatening not just the ability of lawyers to do their jobs, but also the ability of private citizens to hire lawyers to represent them. Joining us to sort out the meaning of all this is Jonathan Schaub, a professor at the University of Kentucky's Rosenberg College of Law, where he teaches courses in constitutional law and federal courts and leads a seminar on executive power. Dr. Schaub has served as senior associate counsel to the president on matters of executive privilege and congressional oversight. His research and expertise have been discussed and quoted by the New York Times, Bloomberg News, The Wall Street Journal, The Washington Post, CNN, and Time, and he has appeared on NPR, on This American Life, Weekend Edition, and Morning Edition. Professor Schaub, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
The Equal Employment Opportunity Commission has sent letters to 20 prominent law firms requesting information about their DEI-related employment practices. These EEOC letters come during Mr. Trump's retribution campaign against several prominent law firms. Mr. Trump has issued an executive order aimed at crippling Perkins Coie, a firm that worked with Hillary Clinton's 2016 presidential campaign. He has revoked the security clearances of lawyers at Covington & Burling who were helping provide legal advice to Jack Smith, the special counsel who led investigations into Mr. Trump. And he has singled out Paul Weiss, Rifkin, Wharton, and Garrison, specifically calling out one of its former lawyers, Mark Pomerantz, who had attempted to build a criminal case against Mr. Trump while he was working at the Manhattan District Attorney's Office several years ago. How are these actions being read in the legal community?
Well, I think they're frightening in many ways. And the judge in the case, Perkins Coie, challenged the action. And the district court judge said something like, "This kind of order sends chills down my spine." There's a bedrock principle of our legal system, right? That's an adversary system. And each individual, no matter sort of what they've done, is entitled to representation. You have parties represented on both sides. They can present their issues to the court, and the court decides. What we're seeing is a sort of dedicated campaign of retaliation against attorneys for representing particular clients, for taking particular positions. And that's really anathema to our legal system. The idea is that attorneys should be able to represent their clients zealously. And the government, in particular, the president, is supposed to be neutral, right, about the viewpoints expressed, and particularly with attorneys who are really just representing clients and not even expressing their own viewpoints, but trying to represent their client's voice. And so this, I think, is unprecedented, and it is frightening in the sense of it undermines a bedrock principle of our legal system.
Well, in a practical, operational sense, what does it mean to a Washington law firm when its attorneys are barred from entering government buildings, from getting government jobs, or getting paid from federal contracts, and when their security clearances are revoked?
Yeah, it can really be devastating. I mean, a number of these law firms have government contracts that they work on. They work in the national security area. All of these things are necessary components to be able to represent certain clients. And if they can't have a security clearance, if they can't engage with contractors, they can't enter buildings, they're really at a disadvantage and they will lose clients and not be able to represent certain clients. And that's already started to happen, I think. And that's the point, I think. You know, the idea is to cripple these firms, to punish them for what President Trump perceives as their campaign against him or actions of certain lawyers that were taken against him. So that the whole point is to cripple them, and it certainly will.
So the key issue here is whether law firms can be threatened or penalized merely for representing somebody or engaging in otherwise fully legal activity.
Right. And the judge that has heard at least part of this has very stridently saying this is certainly unconstitutional for the government to take actions penalizing a firm for views they have expressed directly contrary to sort of fundamental First Amendment principles.
What kind of bind does this create for a law firm? After all, they are businesses.
Yeah, it's kind of tough. I mean, it's a little bit surprising to me that we haven't seen more of a collective response from, you know, you talk about the Am Law 100, the sort of largest law firms in the country, that to condemn this. I mean, there has been some action. Williams & Connolly, which is a very well-known, prestigious firm, is representing Perkins Coie in the lawsuit. And they took the somewhat unusual step of having 14 partners sign the filing, including the former chair of the firm, making, a point to say this was they were behind this and they thought this was a troubling precedent. But there hasn't been a sort of blanket statement or joint statement or even many individual statements condemning this action. And I think in part, they're acting like businesses, right? And they have to keep clients. They don't want to catch the ire of President Trump or the administration and be the next target of an executive order. So they're trying to walk a fine line of not losing business by their actions, but also, you know, maintaining the integrity that you would expect of lawyers and attorneys, members of the bar.
On the client side of this, how can these actions affect the ability of somebody whose views clash with those of the administration? How can it affect their ability to find legal representation?
Yeah, it's sort of the same type of chilling effect of the firms being unwilling to take on a client who might draw the ire of the president. You know, for instance, former special counsel Jack Smith, who was represented by lawyers at Covington and Burling. You could see another firm being unwilling to take on him or a similar client for fear that the same thing might happen. And again, I think that's the point of these kinds of orders, is to both chill the law firms from making arguments, but also to chill the law firms from taking on clients who are adverse to the administration. And we haven't seen examples of that yet. I do think there are enough lawyers in D.C. And enough attorneys who are sort of committed to the fundamental principle that each person deserves representation that I do think they would be able to find someone, but it comes at a risk to the firm.
Well, this question may be outdated by the time we can get this on the air. Things are so fluid right now, but I'll ask it anyway, because maybe it won't be. And that is, if President Trump refuses to comply with a court order, a very clear court order, what then can the courts do?
So there's a couple of actions. And, you know, from what we have seen with the deportation under the Alien Enemies Act, Judge Boasberg in D.C. is right now demanding information from the Department of Justice about whether they complied with his order he issued, and it seems like they may not have. One action a court can take is to hold people in contempt. It's an inherent judicial power. They can, with their contempt power, issue fines to the lawyers. They can put them in prison for contempt of a court order. You could see actions for disbarment or sanctions on the lawyers for representations they've made if they are not accurate. The courts do have substantial inherent power to enforce their orders, but, you know, they don't have a large staff. So the people that usually enforce contempt are the U.S. Marshals, and the U.S. Marshals ultimately report to the Attorney General. So if you really come to this sort of constitutional clash where the court is ordering the marshals to take someone into custody, you could conceivably have an attorney general who gives them a contrary order. And it's, you know, I don't know what happens then, right? That's the, in many ways, I think that's the sort of flashpoint for our democracy and our constitution. There has never been a president who has openly flouted a Supreme Court order. And, you know, I think many people think that's the Rubicon, that if we cross that, we've crossed out of democracy and constitutional order.
Well, what are the dangers of the courts failing to uphold the law?
Well, sort of precept of our Constitution, right, is that it's a system of laws that bind the president just like they bind any other individual. And if there is a law that the president flouts, we've looked to the courts to constrain and to interpret the Constitution since from the very beginning. You know, in Marbury v. Madison, Chief Justice Marshall says it's emphatically the province and the duty of the judiciary to say what the law is. That has sort of guided our system and been a principle of constitutional order. And if we don't have that, then we're not ruled by law. We're ruled by whoever is in charge and whatever they decide to do. And so that's what's at stake in terms of, you know, complying with court orders.
You know, it's often said that Americans are kind of checked out these days and are not following what's going on. I don't think that's true, at least in my universe, my world. A lot of the people that I talk with are very tuned into what's going on. And they're wondering, what's going on here? Is this some sort of exercise in testing boundaries and guardrails to see if they'll hold?
I think it's a combination of two things. You know, one is the presidency has grown in power considerably, particularly over the last, you know, 100 years. And so we see a very robust presidency that has a lot of norms that guide it that are not necessarily enforced by laws or courts, but just our sort of general understanding. And President Trump has shown a willingness to exert the maximum authority possible, regardless of what norms have existed before. And the other half of it is there's been a pretty good separation between the political national interests and the personal interests of the president. And presidents have acted, I think, generally in the national interest and not always in their personal interest. And President Trump seems willing to use maximum executive authority to pursue personal interests like, you know, retaliation against law firms. And so I think we're seeing this sort of maximalist exertion of power across the federal government, and combined with the personal interest and without the sort of norms that typically constrain behavior. And, you know, the other thing that has to be mentioned is Congress also has done nothing. And so a lot of these actions that they're taking are infringing on congressional power to spend money, to create agencies. And Congress hasn't really made a peep about protecting its institutional prerogatives, which part of the design is to have checks and balances. And so if you don't have that check or the congressional check, it makes the presidency even more powerful.
Maybe one way for us to appreciate just how powerful the executive order can be is to think back to early World War II, when through executive order, internment camps were set up for Japanese Americans. That can happen.
And that's it's the same law, actually, that President Trump has invoked, the Alien Enemies Act, which has not been invoked since World War II and requires a war. And the administration has said we're under essentially a war from immigration and from certain gangs. But that's the awesome power that can be unlocked in the presidency, particularly in a time of war or emergency. And the Trump administration has relied on that same law that allowed the internment of Japanese Americans in World War II and the sort of stain on American history that represents. We're now sort of utilizing the same law today to deport certain people and other things. And I think that's a good example of where we are.
Chief Justice John Roberts warned on New Year's Eve that judges nationwide are under increasing threat from violence, intimidation, disinformation, and officials threatening to defy lawful court decisions or to revoke their lifetime appointments. Justice Roberts said, quote, "An independent judiciary is among the crown jewels of the American system of government. No other country before had found a way to ensure that both the people and their government respect the law. Threats against judges are threats against constitutional government. Everyone should be taking this seriously." Those are the words of Judge Richard Sullivan, whom Trump nominated to the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit of New York. Do you agree with what Judge Sullivan said, that everybody should be taking this seriously?
Oh, definitely. I think one way to do that is to think about a president that you disagree with, you know, whatever your political persuasion is, and imagine if you want them to have unchecked power, because you may like what Trump is doing, but you also could have another president that would exert the same powers. And I think the idea of the independent judiciary is to serve as a check on the federal government and on the presidency. Roberts said it's very rare for the Chief Justice to respond to news items and said we shouldn't be talking about impeachment based on rulings. And the country hasn't done that for 200 years because that's respected the rulings of judges. If you disagree, you appeal. You don't ask for the impeachment, which Elon Musk and others have done. And so I think we're at a real time of crisis where people are threatening, calling for the impeachment of judges, which is the independent check in the third branch of government that we have relied on to maintain our constitution and our democracy.
Well, as we said in the beginning, this is a very fluid moment, and we probably will need to darken your door again, maybe a few times. Jonathan Schaub, Associate Professor of Law and Public Policy at the University of Kentucky's Rosenberg College of Law, where he teaches courses in constitutional law and federal courts. Thank you so much.
Oh, thanks for having me.
In times like these, it's as important as ever to fully understand how government and citizenship work. But a group of Kentucky students is raising concerns about civics education in Kentucky schools. And in early April, they'll be launching a series of public hearings to call attention to and discuss those concerns. Joining us with details is Ivy Litton, a senior at Rowan County High School in Moorhead, and policy coordinator for the Kentucky Student Voice Team. Welcome to Eastern Standard, Ivy.
Thank you.
So tell us, why have students organized this series of hearings on civic education?
Yeah, great question. So following the lawsuit, it became, and following our research, it became very clear that civic education is lacking in Kentucky. And civic education is one of the most fundamental things to have a thriving democracy and a thriving Commonwealth. Students need to be able to participate in government. They need to be able to know how to vote and to know how to be active citizens. And too many Kentucky students are leaving school without that knowledge or experience that they need to really engage in a meaningful way. And so we wanted to bring attention to this issue from a student perspective, to not just, you know, identify those ways in which schools are failing students, but also to really highlight schools and communities that are getting that right and are being successful, so that we can compile that information and use it to make real actionable steps that can facilitate change here in Kentucky.
Okay, you mentioned that lawsuit, and we'll touch on that in just a moment. But before we get to that, the research that you mentioned, I know the Kentucky Student Voice Team recently released a report, Beyond the Ballot, the State of Civic Education in Kentucky. What were some key findings of that report?
So this report essentially found that many Kentucky students just aren't prepared to participate in democracy after they graduate high school. So that can be for a variety of reasons, but fundamentally, they're just lacking that exposure to civic education. They're not having classes about government processes. It's getting skipped over in social studies classes and history classes, and they're not getting any kind of real-world opportunities to practice that and to learn how to be an adult and how to be a functioning citizen in Kentucky. So a major issue here is that Kentucky is one of 11 states in the country that doesn't require a civics course at all. And so in my experience, we did have to take a civics exam, and that is required, but most of the time they're giving students the answers, or they're, you know, not teaching them the content prior to taking that exam. And so there's no deeper learning there, and students aren't getting the education and the foundation they need to be successful. And so what this report found confirmed that and showed us that students overwhelmingly don't feel prepared graduating high school to go vote and to go be citizens and participate in civics and be active in government.
Well, back in January, the Kentucky Student Voice Team filed a lawsuit in Franklin County Circuit Court. And it alleges that the Kentucky government has failed to meet a constitutional obligation, which was clarified in the 1989 Rose versus Council for a Better Education decision, the obligation to provide an adequate education for all students. Are these hearings on civics education kind of an extension of that lawsuit?
Yeah, these hearings are absolutely connected to that lawsuit, and they're very much going to mirror the public forums that we held leading up to the lawsuit. And those public hearings or those public forums really helped us to identify the issues and prove that there was injury to students that we could then put in a lawsuit. But the key difference here in these hearings versus those forums, so these hearings are going to be focused on what we can positively, proactively do. So we're going to be looking at the things that are going well in Kentucky and what students and educators and real experts in education say that we need to be doing in order to have an actionable plan that we can hopefully elevate and amplify so that policymakers can then take action and use what we find works to improve civic education to actually change civic education in Kentucky.
So what will happen at the April 5th event at the Carnegie Center?
April 5th is just the first in a series of public hearings, and we're going to invite students, educators, and experts to come together and answer some questions, and we want to hear from people across the state about what is going on in Kentucky in terms of civic education. And so in order to do this, we're going to have some hearings examiners, which are going to be students who are members of KSVT, including myself. And we're going to be asking questions and trying to build innovative solutions to really build a comprehensive picture of what civics education needs to look like here in Kentucky. Essentially, we're going to have a panel of hearings examiners, and we're going to hear from pre-selected experts, including students, educators, and experts, to share their experiences and their thoughts on civics education to hopefully build those solutions that I was talking about.
All right. And as a policy coordinator with the Kentucky Student Voice Team, you're certainly learning a ton about how all this works. I'm just wondering, what is Ivy Litton's future after high school?
Yeah, so I'm graduating in May. I've absolutely loved my time with Kentucky Student Voice Team. I'm planning to stay involved as a senior advisor, helping out where I can. Personally, I'm going to attend college at Washington and Lee in Virginia. I'm going to major in politics. And then I'm planning to go to law school eventually and continue doing this kind of work in adulthood. But that's a long way off. that's the goal.
That's Ivy Litton. She is a senior at Rowan County High School of Moorhead, and she's policy coordinator for the Kentucky Student Voice Team. Thank you so much, Ivy.
Thank you.
Coming up after the break, sculptor Amanda Matthews, the civil rights photography of Calvert McCann, and the music of Haitian Creole jazz drummer John Byrne Thomas. I'm Tom Martin. You're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
The WEKU Daily News Podcast is now available for download. It's available weekday afternoons and includes the top five stories of the day. The WEKU News Podcast is available on the WEKU app, Apple, Spotify, and WEKU.org.
You're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU. I'm Tom Martin. Amanda Matthews is a writer, public speaker, filmmaker, and CEO of Prometheus Art, a design-build firm in Lexington. Her work includes The Girl Puzzle. It's a monument on Roosevelt Island in New York City, honoring the legacy of Nellie Bly, who did a lot of things. World War I correspondent, suffragist, inventor, and humanitarian. But perhaps she's best known as the investigative journalist who, in 1887, had herself committed to an asylum in New York for 10 days so she could expose the horrible conditions there. Her report on the asylum inspired change and helped pave the way for women in journalism. In early March, the monument was the setting when Amanda was back in New York speaking before the United Nations. She's here with us in the studio to recall that experience. Welcome, Amanda.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So first of all, tell us about your time at the UN. What was the occasion?
The occasion was the launch of the 69th United Nations session of the Commission on the Status of Women, but also the 30th anniversary of the Beijing Declaration and Platform for Action, which is about women's rights as well.
I mentioned Nellie Bly, and of course that's what your monument is about. What should everyone know about Nellie Bly?
Well, let me say this first. The monument is honoring Nellie Bly, who transcended her place in history for sure. I mean, you just mentioned all of the titles that belong to her, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Also, world record breaker. She was the first woman to circumnavigate the earth alone. So she has many titles. And the monument honors the fact that she transcended her place in history and advocated for so many marginalized people, in particular women and girls. Something that I want people to know about the monument is there are five giant faces of different diverse women and girls, and four of those are fellow Kentuckians, because Nellie Bly's words that she wrote passionately while she was incarcerated on that island, her descriptions of the women that she was in the asylum with reminded me of people that I know. And I could just see their faces in her descriptions. So as far as a local connection, that is certainly something I want the listeners to know.
In mid-February, prior to your appearance at the UN event in New York, the Trump administration had warned the United Nations organizations UNICEF and UN Women against any focus on diversity, equity, inclusion, and gender ideology. And the National Endowment for the Arts is eliminating the grant program Challenge America. That one supports diversity, equity, and inclusion in underserved communities. Applicants for all remaining NEA grants now must follow guidelines stating that they will not operate any programs promoting diversity, equity, and inclusion that violate any applicable federal anti-discrimination laws or use federal funds to promote gender ideology. Central to your work, Amanda, are gender, equality, fairness, human rights, community, accessibility. So maybe we could ask you to channel Nellie Bly here and tell us what her response to that would be.
I think Nellie Bly's response to that would be exactly the same as Nellie Bly's response to that 140 years ago. Nellie Bly was a firebrand. She suffered losses and injustices in her own life. And I think because of that, it encouraged her empathy for others. And, you know, when you get to the point where you've lost just about everything, you lose your inhibitions as well. And I think she found her voice, she found her power, and she thought she could do something to benefit others by using her voice and her power. So as I was researching Nellie Bly, I was so inspired by her work, but not just her writing. I was so inspired by her actions that I felt called to continue her great work in some way through this monument. And that is why you see these giant faces of marginalized women and girls in the monument, because they may have been faces of those who she advocated for then, and I think she would be faces of those she would advocate for now.
What was the connection between your installation on Roosevelt Island and this United Nations event that you spoke for?
So the United Nations event was for the launch of the 69th session of the Commission on the Status of Women. And the connection, as I understand it, is the ambassador from Switzerland once lived on Roosevelt Island. So she has a very strong connection. When I received the invitation to come speak, and I didn't speak to the Council on Women, the invitation went out to ambassadors and dignitaries and ministers and delegates of all 193 member nations. So there were dozens and dozens of representatives from member nations, you know, in attendance. But when I received the invitation to speak, it was explained to me that they wanted me to speak because this monument embodies what they stand for the United Nations women and United Nations girls. And so I think it spoke to them in a way that art does speak. I think art and artists are incredible messengers of not only who we are as communities, but who we should be.
At the time of the event, when you were in New York, the world was beginning to realize what was happening here in the United States, and many allies were putting us at arm's length. When you were there among people from all over the world, did you get a sense of this? Were there any comments about what's happening here in this country?
Yes, unfortunately, I did. I think it's probably important to note that I believe I was the only American in attendance, other than my family, who actually walked with us to the monument. So I was invited to attend the closed diplomatic meeting that occurred just prior to the walk or march to the monument. And I gave my presentation publicly in front of the monument, which, by the way, is one of the world's largest monuments honoring diverse women. So as the only American who was there, I felt this incredible obligation to try to represent us in the best light possible. But there were concerns and fears and nervousness, because in many ways, the United States has been such a leader in the world in giving and in supporting research and in the arts and culture. And I think we're seeing such a reduction and a contraction in that. All of these things cause our allies and our friends and our partners and our neighbors throughout the world to be concerned.
I haven't visited the Girl Puzzle yet, and I intend to next time I'm in New York, but I certainly have seen plenty of photographs, and it's really impressive. As a videographer, you know that since we're radio, we're at a disadvantage here. So I wonder if, for our listeners, if you could just give them a mind's eye description of what they would find if they went out on Roosevelt Island.
Well, as you approach the monument, you see the faces. And as you continue to walk toward them, because New York City is a pretty big place, as you continue to walk toward them, they just continue to get bigger and bigger and bigger. They are very much on a monumental scale. But you see the faces of my friends and family members who I saw in Nellie Bly's work, including an older queer woman, which happens to be my oldest daughter, aged forward 50 years, showing the hopeful long trajectory of her life. And then you see one of my great friends who's a Black American woman who has dedicated her life to serving others. And you see a Japanese American woman who is a friend of mine who recently passed, who was interned at Rower, the concentration camp, you know, in 1942 under the executive order of President Roosevelt at the time. And so her face is actually facing the south side of the island, which is where Four Freedoms Park is located, where there is an equal-sized bronze head of President Roosevelt. And I have her facing him to show that they were unequal in their power, but they are equal in their humanity. And then finally, you see a young girl, which is representative of my other child, who is also a member of the queer community. And that child represents a bold story that Nellie Bly told about a young girl that had been institutionalized for 4 years. But she came to Nellie Bly every morning, and she said, "I dreamed of my mother last night. I think she may come today and take me home." And we have to have more people like Nellie Bly who are willing to feel the empathy for one young child, who are willing to say, this is a good place for believers in women's rights. And this monument tries to convey that. It shows Nellie Bly kind of looking over all of these other women and girls' faces as if to say, I'm here. I'm going to always speak for you and protect you if I can. So that's the feel and that's the feedback of what I get from people who visit the monument as well.
Wonderful. And something you said should serve as a reminder to all of us of just how powerful and impactful these executive orders can be.
Absolutely. Yes. They have immediate and ripple effects that are unimaginable sometimes.
Amanda Matthews, writer, public speaker, filmmaker, and CEO of Prometheus Art in Lexington. You can learn more about the Girl Puzzle Monument and see photos online at thegirlpuzzle.com.
Nellie Bly was just a girl born into a world when little girls barely matter.
See, even doing our part to help Lexington celebrate its 250th year of existence, we've invited Lexington History Museum Director Mandy Higgins to give us the details of each of the exhibits now on display, especially those highlighting individuals who have in some way contributed to the Lexington story. We begin with a display devoted to Calvert McCann. Mandy, tell us about Calvert McCann. Who was he?
So Cal McKeon was a local Lexingtonian, grew up on DeWeese Street, very quiet man. And as a teenager, he was involved in the protests and the sit-ins. He was a photographer. He studied with some local Lexingtonians to learn his skill, and he carried a small camera with him everywhere he went. So when he was involved in these protests, he actually captured some of the only images we have of them, because as you said, the Herald and the Leader chose not to cover such monumental moments. What is incredible about Cal's story for me is that he kept them and didn't develop the film for many years. So we didn't know they were there until Dr. Gerald Smith, the University of Kentucky, asked him about them.
When we ask about it, Dr. Smith recalled encountering McKeon at a photo fair organized by then Lexington History Museum director Ed Houlihan.
He had this one photograph that I remember of African-Americans in Lexington standing in front of the core office. They were actually inside. And I said, oh, my goodness. And I said, do you have any more photographs like this or others? And he was, you know, said, yeah. And so I went by his house and we were talking, and he goes to the back of his house and comes out with really a handful of undeveloped rolls of film. And so I asked him permission to take them, and I said, I'll pay to get them developed. And he's, you know, he said, yeah, that's fine. And so I got them developed. And as soon as I went to pick them up, I sat in my car, Tom, and started going through those photos. And I thought, oh, my goodness. And so I take him to his home, and we sitting there. And I said, Calvert, you know, why didn't you ever get them developed? And he said, well, I thought nobody would really be interested. And I told him, I said, man, you've got a gold mine. I said, this is incredible, Calvert. And so from there, I asked him permission to publish them in a book. I went to all the people that we had got the photographs from, and I got specific permission for me to use them however I wanted to. They signed permission forms. Calvert signed a permission form. When my book on Lexington came out in 2002, of course, Marilyn Davis did a major story on it with photos and all of that. And then the Herald Leader followed up with an apology for not covering the civil rights movement in Lexington. And, you know, because now we have all of these photographs that, you know, Calvert McKeon had taken. And so from that, Calvert and I were on NPR. We were in Elle magazine. We were doing interviews, and, you know, now people wanted Calvert's photographs.
That was University of Kentucky historian and Eastern Standard contributor Gerald Smith. So, Mandy, what was the impact of publishing those images?
Now we have proof that all of these things happened, that we knew as historians were happening, but now we can show it. And a photograph is such a visceral way to grasp history and to know that.
And you have those photos on display.
We have some of those photos on display, and we'll be putting more up throughout the year. Cal's photos were incredible because they caught people. So in our museum right now, the photos are of the protests at the Phoenix, which we can talk about in a moment, mm-hmm. as well as Louis Armstrong refusing to cross the picket line, and an image of a student at Woolworths. And what's incredible about the Woolworths story is that Lexington sit-in at a Woolworths happened before the very famous North Carolina protests that set off SNCC. But because they didn't have the national coverage, we didn't know that.
Those photos of the Woolworths sit-in are iconic.
They're incredible. Audra Grievous catching some of the, you know, he's catching some of these really meaningful, really impactful moments. And what is incredible for us at the museum is not only do we have that image, we also have two of the soda fountain chairs that will be going on display soon. So these chairs just look like chairs. And if you don't know the history behind them, they're just, oh, nostalgia, fun, mm-hmm. 1950s, let's go to the sock hop and get a milkshake. But those are the chairs where Lexington changed.
You mentioned Louis Armstrong, and that photograph is unusual because it captured Louis Armstrong in a moment where he wasn't mugging for the camera, which he often did. he was kind of stunned as he's stepping off his bus in front of the Phoenix and realizing that there's a Corps picket line right there at the entrance. Years later, in 2010, Lexington historian Calvin Graves, then a senior at the University of Kentucky and working on his thesis about civil rights in Lexington, sat down with McCann at the McDonald's on Limestone near the UK campus and asked about that Armstrong photo.
He was supposed to play there in the Phoenix Hotel, down there where, downtown. Is that where the, I'm not sure, is that where the City Hall is? Yeah, I'm not sure.
Yeah, the Phoenix Hotel. Yeah, yeah.
And we asked him not to perform there. Told him that they barred black people from coming in. And he said if he had known, he would have not come. But he had already signed the contract. And he didn't want to get sued, so he went on. He said, next time he would not come.
Mandy, what's the backstory?
So Louis Armstrong was hired to play a private party at the Phoenix Hotel. He didn't know what was going on, and he, as you said, was caught by surprise. So that photograph catches the, you can kind of see his wheels spinning, like, what am I going to do? Am I going to cross this line? I have this thing that I'm going to get paid for, but these are my people. What do I do? And he does not cross that line. The other part of that that I think is so incredible, well, one, that Louis Armstrong would be in Lexington for a private party in the 1950s, which tells you everything you need to know about Lexington in the 1950s, right? Like, we always loved our jazz. But also that that story is often buried under the basketball story, which is a great story, too. But that we can't, for whatever reason, we're not holding both. That, you know, the Celtics and the Hawks leaving that exhibition game is often held up as the sort of height of the moment, but it was just one example of a long-standing protest in downtown to desegregate those spaces.
And you know, what you just did is something that's so interesting to me in these conversations, in that we're talking about Cal McCann, and there's so much more to the story, but it also brings up all this other history about the Louis Armstrong appearance, about the basketball story, as you mentioned. And there's another aspect to Cal McCann that many of our listeners may not realize, and that is, who was his brother?
His brother was Les McCann. Les just passed in the last year. He is the most sampled jazz artist in the history of music.
Here's a little sampling from Les McCann performing Real Compared to What with Eddie Harris at the Montreux Jazz Festival in 1969.
Everybody now trying to make it real compared to what. Come on, baby.
What can you tell us about Les McCann?
He learned to play by ear at the Charles Young Center on 3rd Street. Was just really, really musically talented, left Lexington, spent most of his life in Los Angeles as a, you know, producing and creating jazz music. Really, really well-respected, profoundly talented. And another one of those stories where if you know the McCanns, you know the story, right? And if you spent some time in the lyric, you know that story. But if you don't, it's the surprising piece of Lexington that folks find hard to believe.
And all the more reason to pay a visit to the Lexington History Museum.
Absolutely. We'd love to have you.
All right. Thanks so much, Mandy.
Thank you.
You can find an article about Louis Armstrong's visits to Lexington featuring photographs by Cal McCann on our partner website, undermainarts.org. Since traveling to far-flung places isn't for everybody, Green Room Exchange brings international artists to Lexington. And on April 5th, in partnership with the Origins Jazz Series, it's Haitian drummer John Byrne Thomas with special guests Aaron Goldberg, Dion Kerr, Jacques Schwartz-Bart, and Lexington's own Zach Brock. And we have John Byrne Thomas on the line from the latest stop on his tour in Indianapolis. Greetings, John Byrne.
Super evening, beautiful people. Hi, Tom. How you doing today?
Doing really good. And briefly, if we could, John Byrne, a little bit of background. I know that you grew up with eight siblings, I believe, and Quatabuque, a commune north of Port-au-Prince, where music is a constant. If you would, tell us about growing up in that atmosphere and how it influenced you to take up drumming.
I've been playing music since growing up because my daddy's also a drummer. Starting at churches until I meet other musicians, discovering my talent and start like pulling my ear, helping me understand music in a different way. So, of course, I grew up in an American school in the south part of Haiti at St. Mark. And then at 14 year old, I came back to Port-au-Prince. This is where I start really meeting other musicians with the different backgrounds that start really helping me understand different type of music, dynamic of music. And I started engaging myself professionally 13 years ago, like playing jazz music and helping my country developing in social and different stuff.
I know that in January of 2010, you were getting ready for a really big opportunity performing in Haiti's 2010 International Jazz Festival when that devastating 7.2 earthquake struck and you had to leave what was the only home that you'd ever known, and you had to go to the Dominican Republic to earn a living and learn to speak the language. Were you able to continue to rehearse and perform when you made that transition?
Yeah, that was a big transition in my life because after the earthquake, which I have like a very special story, because I was on my drums when the earthquake happens. I was practicing. Then it happens after a week. There was nothing to do. We couldn't perform, and I was getting ready to perform at the jazz festival for the first time at my age. And then I had no choice but leaving Haiti and have like a different experience in the Dominican Republic, where I was able to meet different like painters, intellectual people that, you know, wanted to support me. And from there, I met Rafael Tomilabal, who started opening doors for me, and I started touring and playing with different musicians and learning the musical language and also learning Spanish, which was not something I did like. So from 2010 to 2012, I was in the Dominican Republic sharing music, learning from, you know, different people over there.
You touched on this just briefly earlier, but with the current political turmoil, how are Haitian musicians surviving? How are they responding to the situation?
Well, it has always been like that. Haiti's story, it's so vast, it's so big. But since I've been growing up, I was born in 1986. So the struggle of Haiti started way, way, way back then. But like politically talking, it really started in 1986, where like each president, they always have like protesters on the street, burning tires, like, you know, asking for the president to leave. So I grew up around that type of thing. So nowadays, musicians have been like suffering a lot, but still we have a big jazz festival in Haiti where it still happens, even the political situation. They always find a way of organizing the festival, either in Port-au-Prince or on the countryside. So musicians over there are still practicing, but it's not the same thing as if they will be able like to perform as if the country was stable, politically talking. So because people can't really go out at night, but they're still practicing and they're still like performing. They're still doing what they can to make a living. But it's really, really, really hard for now.
Among those performing with you here in Lexington is the jazz pianist Aaron Goldberg, who you've known for quite some time. Can you tell us how you met?
Well, in 2007, we had the jazz festival happening. Myself, I was still very young, going to all the workshops, all the jam sessions. And I had to walk hours, you know, because I didn't have money to, you know, to pay the entrance. But I had to go there doing sound checks sometimes to be able to meet musicians, at least to learn, go to the workshops. So I was at that hotel in Port-au-Prince, and I saw Aaron was walking, and he saw the banner say Jazz Festival. He was like, Jazz Festival? There's a jazz festival in Haiti? I was like, yeah, there's a jazz festival in Haiti. Do you love music? He was like, kind of, yeah, I love music. But he didn't really tell me who he was because he was just visiting his friend in Haiti. I was like, yeah, this is where it's happening. And he walked, and there was some musician sounds checking for the jam session. And then once he came in, I saw these guys were looking at him differently, and they would start talking between them. Then I introduced him to, you know, to everyone. And then he came at the jam session at night, And then I saw him playing. That blows my mind away. But during the day, he was like, oh, yeah, I play the piano. And I saw Jean Caz, which is a Haitian-American trumpet player, was talking to him. And I realized that he was a musician. Once he told me he was Aaron Goldberg, and I asked him, who do you play with? He said, oh, yeah, you know, I play with everyone. He didn't really like, he's very humble. Then I called my professor, which is Claude Carré, which is a guitar player who's like training lots of Haitian young jazz musicians in Haiti. So Claude Carré told me, Aaron Goldberg, you don't know who you just met. You met Aaron Goldberg, who tours with Joshua Redman. I've already knew who Joshua Redman was. And I was like, what? And I ran through him and he said, bro, we got an exchange number. You want to play some music? I can create, like, organize something at my professor's house. He was like, yeah, sure. The next day we pick him up, we go, and we had, like, snacks and everything. And I invited him. We jam, we play. Since then, we've been great friends. Aaron Goldberg with his friends, Eric Arlen, and bought me my first drum.
So I was going to ask you about that. I know that was he did something very special for you. Tell us about that.
Well, yeah, he was like, how do you practice? You're very young, very talented. I was like, I practice with my pillow. He was like, oh, wow, you never had a drums before? I said, no, I don't. Well, do you want to have a drums? I was like, oh, I would love to have a drums. He said, I can buy the drums or I can talk to my friends. Do you know Eric Arlen? I was like, no. Then him and Eric, they put together, they bought me a drums and they sent me a very nice kit. It was a Yamaha Roger. And since then, I really start practicing drums, you know. It was very special. Aaron is a great friend. He's a great human being, a great, great collaborator.
That's a wonderful story. John Byrne Thomas performing for the latest Green Room Exchange concert at the Pam Miller Downtown Arts Center in Lexington. That's on Saturday, April 5th, 7 p.m. More information at greenroomexchange.org. John Byrne, thank you so much for this, and we look forward to hearing you.
I really do appreciate that, Tom. Thanks for doing what you're doing.
Thanks for joining us, and a heads up, the initial airtime for Eastern Standard moves to 1 p.m. as of our April 3rd edition. Rebroadcasts continue at 8 p.m. on Thursdays and 6 p.m. on Sundays. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions. Mike Savage, executive producer, Neil Kesterson, sound designer and technical director, Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. We're online at esweku.org, where you can check out our archive, our series, our partners, and sign up for our newsletter. You can find Eastern Standard on weku.org, on the WEKU app, and podcast versions are on Apple, Spotify, and the NPR app. Want to call something to our attention or suggest a topic? Our email is es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.